From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Think about the predictions you've heard from pundits and experts over the last few years. Have you gone back to test how they did at actually forecasting the future? Well, Wharton Professor Philip Tetlock has, and his research has revealed that even an expert's predictions are only slightly better than chance, than throwing a dart or shaking a magic eight ball. But Tetlock has also found that there are people out there who are good at this, really good, in fact, and he calls them super forecasters. And what is it that made them so good at predicting what will happen? Well, it wasn't what they thought that made the difference. It was how they thought. They were open-minded and careful and curious. And here's the biggie. Tetlock says super forecasters are self-critical. Philip Tetlock is joining us today to talk about the art and science of prediction after the news. This week in Video West, meet the General. He's a friend of Utah filmmaker M.P. Cunningham, and he's gone through a rough patch lately. He's homeless. It's a beautiful portrait of pride and regret. Also, we have a nice short about young farmers, which will make you feel wistful about summer and your garden. Go to videowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the psychologist and scholar Philip Tetlock is joining us to talk about the art and science of prediction. And it takes both things, art and science, it turns out, a kind of symbiosis of judgment and then processing the numbers. Tetlock has found that a lot of what passes for forecasting or making predictions these days is mostly just educated guesses made by smart and confident people. The people who are really good at this generally don't end up on the Sunday talk shows. In his new book, Tetlock calls these people super forecasters. And he says they aren't gurus or oracles. They have real, measurable skills at judging how high-stakes events are likely to unfold. Super forecasters, he says, have foresight, which, he says, isn't a mysterious gift you're born with. It's the byproduct of a way of thinking. It's about focus. It's about curiosity. It's about gathering information and being open-minded about it, being willing to question it and then question yourself as well. And here's the thing. This skill is something you can learn and cultivate. The book is called Super Forecasting, The Art and Science of Prediction. Philip Tetlock is joining us, as I said, to talk about it today. The book is co-written with the journalist Dan Gardner. Philip Tetlock is the Annenberg University professor at the University of Pennsylvania, where he holds appointments in the psychology and political science departments in the Wharton School of Business. He's joining us today from a studio on the campus of the Wharton Business School in Philadelphia. Professor Tetlock, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much.
So I wanted let me begin with the pronouncement you make on the first page of the book. We are all forecasters. Explain in what way.
Yes, sir. Every time we make a decision, we make a decision based on implicit or explicit expectations about what's going to happen afterward. And that means we're making a forecast. When you're deciding whether you're going to date somebody or get engaged or married, you're making forecasts about your compatibility with that person months and years into the future. When you make a decision about whether to take a job, you're making implicit predictions about how happy you're going to be in that job. And similarly, when the intelligence community makes predictions about whether Russia is going to continue invading the Ukraine or there will be violent Sino-Japanese clashes somewhere, those are also forecasts. So we're all in the forecasting business one way or another.
When did you start thinking about forecasting? I mean, you've been at this a long time, the idea of predictions and how it works, how human psychology processes all of this. When did you get started thinking about this?
Well, you're going to force me to reveal how old I am. I got started back in 1984, just before Mikhail Gorbachev became the General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. And by the time I'd finished my first book on the subject in 2005, Gorbachev was doing commercials for Pizza Hut.
Right.
So a lot of things changed between 1984 and 2005, and very, very few people predicted them. The later work has caused me to be more optimistic about the potential for forecasting. That's work that forecasting tournament sponsored by the U.S. intelligence community.
Well, we're going to talk about all of that because I think it's really interesting. Early on in the book, you introduce us to Bill Flack. This is a man who forecasts global events, though he has a much more modest profile than someone like Tom Friedman, whom you write about in the book as well, doesn't get to go on the cable news shows, as I sort of referred to earlier. But nevertheless, you say he's a remarkable forecaster. He's a super forecaster. Now, we're going to break this down as we go. What is it that makes a super forecaster? But give us a sense, just a general sense, a broad sense of this, first of all, through Bill Flack, how he is a super forecaster.
Bill is a super forecaster because we have been able to measure his forecasts over an extended period of time on hundreds of questions posed by the U.S. intelligence community. And we've recorded the forecasts and we've recorded what later happened. And we know that he's particularly skilled at assigning higher probabilities to things that happen than to things that don't happen. We don't know that about Tom Friedman, and we don't know that about the vast majority of political pundits because they tend to make vague verbiage forecasts. They don't use numerical probabilities that can be scored for accuracy. They say things like, well, there's a distinct possibility there'll be a global depression in 2016. Distinct possibility could mean anything from about a 20% probability to about an 80% probability. So you're really covering a lot of ground when you say something like distinct possibility. If there is a global depression or recession, you can say, I told you there was a distinct possibility of that. And if nothing happens, you can say, well, I just said it was a possibility.
Right. Well, this is something of a theme in the book because you point out every day all around the world, corporations and governments and people in, you know, going to the voting booth are making these important decisions based on forecasts whose quality really is unknown. You say that we're content, though, to be ignorant. What do you mean?
I think we've grown accustomed to living in a blame game political culture in which we understand that for politicians and intelligence analysts and pundits to survive politically, they need to be vague. They need that kind of coverage. No one, not even the super forecasters, is always going to be on the right side of maybe on every question. Even the very best forecasters are going to be wrong sometimes. And that can be very damaging to your credibility if you're a professional in that field, like as politician or intelligence analyst or pundit. So that's why they prefer to say things are a distinct possibility or something could happen or might happen or may happen. They like to cover themselves. And they do so very adroitly. They become very skillful at it. But it's a survival strategy for existing in a blame game culture. Mm. When we run forecasting tournaments, we create a very special artificial type of environment in which ideology and politics are completely put aside, and all that matters is the accuracy of your judgment.
There are a couple of phases, two in particular anyway, of your research over the last 20, 30 years. Let's explain this big 20-year project, the first one that you mentioned got started in 1984. And you set out to measure just how well the predictions and judgments of experts actually played out. And the analogy or joke that you're not so crazy about these days that was used to sum up the research was this, that the average expert was roughly as accurate as a dart-throwing chimpanzee. Now, we'll talk about what your problem with that analogy in a moment, but give us a sense of what this research was about, this 20-year project that you set out.
Well, back in 1984, Ronald Reagan was running for re-election as president. The Soviet Union had shot down a Korean airliner near Siberia. There were nuclear alerts. Some very smart people thought that we were edging toward a nuclear apocalypse. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists moved its doomsday clock closer to midnight. Mm. So a lot of very smart people thought we were teetering on the edge. And I was interested in how accurate they might prove to be going forward.
What's wrong with that analogy? Because people writing about it, the chimpanzee analogy, I mean, you said it oversimplified the results. I mean, it's not true that all expert forecasts are useless, even though some are. Many are, I guess. The debunkers go too far is what you were saying.
Well, different. You don't want to put all experts in the same basket. Right. Experts are human beings, and human beings are quite diverse. And some experts have more modest, self-critical styles of thinking, and we call them foxes. And other experts have more bombastic, self-justifying styles of thinking, and we call them hedgehogs. And the hedgehogs were the ones who really were having a hard time beating the dart-throwing chimp. The foxes did better. Now, for long-range forecasts, even the foxes can't do very well. Yeah. I mean, the further out in time you try to see, the closer your performance degrades to that of the dart-throwing chimp. Right. It's sort of like when you go to your optometrist and you're trying to make out the figures on the Snellen chart. And you, if you have good vision, you can see the bottom line from about 20 feet away or so. But virtually nobody can see the bottom line from 100 feet away.
You write about the various points of view on our ability to predict the future. And I wanted to ask you about these. There's kind of a skeptical view, and then there's the more optimistic view. And I want to get a sense of where you've settled. But let's talk about the skeptical view, this idea that perfect predictability is just impossible. It's out of reach. And you tell about this in the book. You tell a story to kind of illustrate this, the story of Mohamed Bouazizi from Tunisia. In 2010, he's despondent, feeling powerless about official corruption, and he sets himself on fire. And in effect, this begins the Arab Spring. Would you talk a little bit about this story and just how this makes a really important point?
Yes. Well, it's an appallingly sad story about a young man who was hounded by police corruption to the point where he saw no alternative but to pour gasoline over himself and light a match, and he died a horribly painful death. Now, that particular incident was what triggered an uprising in Tunisia that had ripple effects throughout the Arab world that we're still experiencing in one form or another. He wasn't the first young man to be hounded by police corruption. He wasn't the first young man to feel desperate in Tunisia. Lots of others were. Unemployment is very high. Corruption is rife. It's an oppressive environment in many ways. Why did that particular incident trigger something, whereas so many other incidents didn't? Nobody really could predict that. Mm-hmm. Nobody could have predicted the self-immolation, and no one really could have predicted that that particular act of suicide would trigger such massive ripple effects. It just happened. Now, you could say there certainly were people who said that these autocratic, corrupt Arab regimes are tinderboxes, and they're just waiting to blow up.
Right.
But you can wait a long time for that.
Right. And the skeptic raises the question, how is it possible that anyone would have been able to foresee, you know, this tiny act of protest could have set off the power keg of the Arab Spring like it did? And it raises that image of the butterfly wing and its potential to set off, you know, these powerful forces across the world. This is what Edward Lorenz, who really began using the image way back in 1972. So this is the skeptical view of it. Explain how this fits into the way you're thinking about our perceptions of the idea of predictability.
Well, I don't think the super forecasters are going to do very well if we ask them to see who's going to win the presidential election of 2028.
Right.
I think they might do a better job than the average person in assigning a likelihood to who's going to win the presidential election of 2016. Because that's a lot closer up, and the contours of that election are starting to come into focus, although there are obviously many unknowns and sources of uncertainty, and nobody can be very confident.
Mm-hmm.
But confidence is a matter of degree, and the super forecasters deal in probabilities. In the book, we talk about a great poker player who was also the chief risk officer of a New York City hedge fund, AQR, and he said that the the way to tell the difference between a world-class poker player and a talented amateur is that the world-class player knows the difference between a 60-40 bet and a 40-60 bet. Then he paused and said, no, maybe it's even 55-45, 45-55. In other words, the very best forecasters are granular in their assessments of uncertainty. They distinguish more degrees of uncertainty than most people do. They can talk in terms of shades of maybe that elude most people.
There's also the optimistic view, which takes into account the fact that human beings have certain behaviors that, of course, can be foreseen and predicted, like traffic and electricity consumption, those kinds of things. And a lot of forecasts are predictable, as you point out in the book. There's weather and tides and eclipses. So this optimistic view, in contrast to this more sort of skeptical point of view, is that you can't ever figure this out, sees the world more like a clock. You've sort of ended up somewhere in between. Is that right? I mean, you describe yourself as an optimistic skeptic in all of this.
I think that's right. If we want to mix the metaphors, you could say we live in a world of both clouds and clocks, yeah. where the clouds are the unpredictable things and the clocks are the very predictable things. And there are lots of things in between that have elements of predictability and elements of unpredictability. And that's the zone where the super forecasters really excel. Anyone can predict a clock if they know how the clock works. And nobody can predict how a roulette wheel is going to land, where the ball is going to land. Skilled forecasters can make much better than chance judgments of the sorts of questions that the U.S. intelligence community posed to them in the forecasting tournaments that ran between 2011 and 2015.
I want to talk about those tournaments when we get back from a break. We have with us Philip Tetlock, along with Dan Gardner, who wrote the book Super Forecasting, The Art and Science of Prediction. You can join us if you like, if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we are talking with the psychologist and scholar Philip Tetlock, who has devoted a career to understanding predictions, forecasts for the future. And he's found that a lot of the guesses that pass for forecasting these days are just that, guesses made by smart, confident people. But there is a group of people who are actually able to, within the right conditions anyway, forecast the future. Tetlock calls them super forecasters. They have certain skills that make them good at this. We're talking about this. And also, here's an insight. This is a skill that you can cultivate. Super Forecasting, The Art and Science of Prediction is the name of the book. We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. All right, let's talk about phase two of your research, your project. This is the Good Judgment Project. Part two, as you said, this began in 2011. Let's talk about this phase. You created this enterprise called the Good Judgment Project. Explain what that is.
The Good Judgment Project was one of five major research university competitors in a forecasting tournament sponsored by the Research and Development Branch of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. So that's a lot of words there. IARPA is the funding agency, and IARPA did something that bureaucracies in Washington, D.C. just are never supposed to do. They funded something that could be potentially embarrassing. Goliath doesn't lend David slingshot money. And IARPA, in effect, did a version of that. They gave us an opportunity to compete against intelligence analysts inside the community. The Good Judgment Project was the entity that had the forecasters who generated the most accurate probability judgments, most accurate in relation to the other research universities that were participating, more accurate than a prediction market, mm-hmm. and more accurate than internal benchmarks within the U.S. intelligence community itself.
Explain when they first began this project, they were part of the Good Judgment group was part of five different teams. But clearly the Good Judgment people were better. And after a certain amount of time, IARPA just dropped everyone else except for the Good Judgment folks, I guess.
That's true. IARPA did pull the plug on the other four competitors after the second year because the margins of victory were so large, and they gave us an opportunity to hire the best talent in the other teams, which we promptly did.
Over this period of time, IARPA posed you say there were about 500 questions that were posed, and these were about world affairs, I think, for the most part. Would you just sort of lay out the questions that you were getting at?
Well, the questions are extremely heterogeneous, so no one individual could claim to be an expert on more than a tiny fraction of these questions. The questions range from will Greece leave the Eurozone to whether Putin will reinvade the Ukraine to whether Britain will leave the Eurozone or whether Scotland will leave Britain or the United Kingdom, or whether there will be violent Sino-Japanese clash in the East China Sea or whether there will be an Ebola or H5N1 breakout in a particular country, whether Arctic sea ice will retreat or expand in a particular region of the Arctic. Extremely heterogeneous. So no one's going to have – is plausibly going to be able to claim that he or she is an expert on these things. So the remarkable thing about super forecasters is what quick studies they were, how quickly they were able to improvise and come up with pretty accurate probability judgments for an extraordinarily diverse array of questions, even in competition with bona fide subject matter experts inside the intelligence community.
I want to ask about the psychology about the way we make decisions, the way we try to sort of forecast the future. One thing that's really interesting is just how much over time, and you refer in particular to medicine as a way of explaining how it is that we cling to our subjective hunches, our ideas, and cling to them for centuries and centuries and centuries. Archie Cochrane is a story that you tell, a patient and a physician, it turns out, but from 1956, this is a particular story. Would you tell the story and illustrate your point here?
Well, Archie Cochrane is an heroic figure in British medicine who was a very early advocate of clinical trials. Instead of relying on physician intuition about what works, you would run controlled experiments. Now, nowadays, this is routine, and of course, the FDA requires any new drug or treatment to pass clinical trials. But when Archie Cochrane was working, this was really quite heretical. The idea was that you would simply rely on the expert judgment of physicians, and many physicians were offended by the idea that their judgment couldn't be trusted.
Mm-hmm. Galen, that second sensory physician you also write about, he's the perfect example. And this raises a really crucial point in your book. Galen, untroubled by doubt, you say in the book, which was part of his problem. And for centuries, medicine was governed by these confident hunches. But doubt is really a key element in all of this, because the super forecasters are willing to throw doubt into the equation, I suppose.
They certainly are. Everything, I think, for the super forecasters and the super forecasting teams is regarded as contingent. They really don't like to use the probability of zero, saying something is categorically impossible, mm-hmm. or the probability of 1.0, saying something is a slam dunk or a certainty. It's much more prudent to say 0.0001 or 0.9999 because it's very few things are truly impossible or inevitable.
What does this tell us about the way we think, this idea of certainty? And this is something that you spend a good deal of time explaining sort of how our brains work. Our brains have these systems, and we are – I guess it's just as a species, or our brains are looking for certainty. We're looking for something to make an explanation of things, I guess.
Yes, indeed. So I think that's true. I think that probability, the concept of probability, really wasn't invented until a few centuries ago. It came later in intellectual history than calculus. So it's not an idea that comes naturally to us. And when you think about human evolution and the conditions under which we evolved on the savanna plains of Africa, it's easy to see why probability doesn't come naturally to us. Imagine you're an early hominid and you're walking through the savanna plains of Africa and you see something, you see a shadow in the long grass. Now, it could be a lion or it could be something quite harmless. It could be nothing. But you have to make a decision, yes or no. Are you going to run? Are you going to get the hell out of there, or are you going to act as though nothing is happening? So, I think in many of the early situations, it was a switch on or off. Right. You're either going to do something, you're not going to do something. And our ancestors who paused for a long time in the maybe zone we're at greater risk of being devoured by real lions lurking in the long grass.
So would you just mention the research of, I think his name is Michael Gunizaga, is that how it's pronounced?
Or Gazzaniga.
Gazzaniga. Yeah. Where he talks about these split brain patients, which gets us to this idea of our compulsion, I guess, to explain, which is mostly a good thing, but you want to talk about
right.
that, if you would?
Well, this was an extremely unusual and complicated neurological situation in which, as a cure for epilepsy, they would sever the left and the right hemispheres. Yeah. And then that created an opportunity for researchers to expose these subjects, these people who had had these the severing of the hemispheres, to expose them to images in the left eye or the right eye. One side of the brain wouldn't know what the other side of the brain had seen.
Right.
When the person makes a judgment about having just seen a chicken, for example, and makes a judgment about the shovel that he sees in another picture is being used to clean out the chicken shed, then the other side of the brain is just utterly baffled and it has no. Simply has to invent. It doesn't know why they've just picked the shovel.
Right.
They have to invent another reason for the shovel because they didn't know that the chicken had been seen prior to that in the left eye. So this is a very complicated experiment and a very unusual situation in which the two halves of people's brains have been severed, and essentially you're talking to two different people inside one skull. So it's an extreme situation. But what it illustrates is how rapidly and seamlessly people invent rationalizations for whatever they just said. They were really good at it.
Yeah. So one of the things that the book points out is you have to let go of certain closely held ideas that experience and perception are not always a reliable way of determining, for example, in medicine, whether a treatment works. And I wanted to ask you about this because it seems like one of the things that we like about our doctors in particular is that they have experience. They have a kind of intuition, and that's going to be to our benefit. But what you seem to be saying here is, in fact, that maybe it should play some kind of role, I suppose, but experience, subjective perception isn't, in fact, terribly reliable, and we need to start thinking about these things in different ways, I guess.
I think that's right. We have a form of national health insurance, the government is ever more actively involved in assessing the cost effectiveness of medical treatments. And insurance companies have been interested in this also, of course, for a long time. And they've become increasingly interested in second guessing doctors, in getting experts to set up expert systems that can diagnose the patient better than the doctor can diagnose his own patient. And you can set up competitions like that even. So this is very controversial. Most people really prefer to think that the doctor they're sitting down in the office with and who's looking into their eyes cares for them, knows what's going on, and could do a far better job than any computer algorithm programmed in from Washington, D.C. or elsewhere. So you have a mismatch there.
Yeah. But it's interesting because it now seems clear that if you have to choose between subjective judgment and a really well-tested, well-validated statistical algorithm that you go with the algorithm. But what does that mean then for subjective judgment? Is that something that we need to set aside, rethink? I mean, or can it play a role in the scheme of things?
Well, subjective judgment certainly can play a major role in many areas of human life. We talked with in the book, we had an interview with David Ferrucci, who is a brilliant scientist who was formerly at IBM, who designed Watson, which was the artificial intelligence system that beat all of the world champion human Jeopardy players.
Right.
If anyone would be, you think would be really optimistic that artificial intelligence is going to sweep everything away, you might think someone like he would be. But he was really very circumspect about this. We talked about how a system like Watson could very easily answer the question, which two Russian leaders changed jobs in the last 10 years? Right. You know, Medvedev and Putin, easy. Mm-hmm. But will two senior Russian leaders trade jobs again in the next 10 years? Looking forward, could Watson answer a question like that? Could it attach a probability to a question like that? And his answer was essentially not in the foreseeable future. The second problem, the forecasting problem, is qualitatively more difficult than the problem where you can look up the answer in a book.
So there's a difference between mimicking human meaning, he said, which the machine is good at doing, and originating meaning. That's our thing, and at least that's going to be our thing for the near future, I guess.
That's right. Now, there's concern that computers are going to be encroaching more and more on white-collar jobs. How far that trend goes, how many lawyers or accountants or physicians or professors, for that matter, are displaced by artificial intelligence systems remains to be seen.
Because you say in the book that we are sort of reaching this historical discontinuity in our relationship with machines. So – not asking you to predict the future here, Professor, but machines won't necessarily displace humans, you don't think, at least not in the near future. But there will be more of what you refer to in the book as the synthesis, this combination of the two things, the machine and human judgment.
I think that's fair. I think that's a growing trend. Human beings using the models and basing their predictions on the models and the but tweaking the models when they think it's appropriate to tweak the models, I think that's a very common form of synthesis. We see this synthesis in chess, where humans and machines play against each other, but they also play with each other. So there are competitions in which human machine combinations are pitted against the best computers, and there are some suggestions that there may be conditions under which the human machines combinations can do better than the best computer. That hasn't been fully replicated yet, but it is the sort of vision many people have that the machines and the people can work very dynamically together. That the machines can make us smarter, and we can improve the accuracy of the machine's forecasts as well.
Here's a question from Ben, who writes from Salt Lake City. We often hear that we should trust our gut when making decisions, that our first answer is often the right one. He wants to know what you think of that. This idea, again, going back to intuition, going back to the idea of relying on your gut. We love that idea of relying on our gut, but how well does that work for us?
Well, Malcolm Gladwell wrote a best-selling book several years ago called Blink, which had a number of chapters which talked about examples in which intuition seemed to serve experts very well. The problem is it's possible to come up with an equally large or even larger number of examples in which expert intuition, their immediate gut response, is wrong. I think our super forecasters tend to be think-twice people. In fact, there is interesting research evidence now that simply asking people to make two estimates. I ask you today, how likely is it that Putin's going to do X? And then I ask you the same question tomorrow, how likely is Putin going to do X? But to think about it from a different point of view, and you take those two answers and you average them, and the average is typically more accurate than either of the individual judgments you made. So there's quite a bit of evidence that taking into account multiple perspectives is very adaptive for making predictions on the sorts of problems that intelligence analysts deal with, and that if you're going to take into account multiple perspectives, you're not going to make decisions on the blink basis.
Philip Tetlock is with us. He, along with Dan Gardner, they're co-authors of the book Super Forecasting, The Art and Science of Prediction. You can join us again, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Wharton Professor Philip Tetlock is joining us. We're talking about his book that he co-wrote along with journalist Dan Gardner, Super Forecasting, The Art and Science of Prediction. I wanted to spend a few more moments talking about the characteristics of super forecasters and what it is that they have foresight. And foresight makes the difference. This is not about math necessarily. But it is interesting, some of the characteristics. You say they tended to be news junkies. They don't tend to spend endless hours on the job. They're curious, you say. They're careful. Above all, you say self-critical, though. Talk a little bit more about these characteristics of super forecasters.
Sure. So super forecasters are more likely to think twice. They have doubts about intuition or the usefulness of intuition, at least in the domains in which we're dealing. I think there may be domains. I mean, in the book, we talk about some domains where rapid intuitive responses might work well, and firefighting and intensive care nurses, people who deal with frequently recurring situations where they can develop genuine expertise. But when you're talking about trying to make predictions in world politics or geoeconomics, very complex systems that are unfolding in a distinctive historical way, you really do need to take into account multiple perspectives, and intuition is by and large not the way to go. So super forecasters do second guess they second guess their gut a lot, and they second guess each other a lot. And remember, the super forecasters work together in super teams, and they were dividing labor. So one of the key things they had to learn how to do is how to disagree with each other without being disagreeable. A lot of people don't like their judgment to be second-guessed. So they developed interesting ways, I think, of handling that problem and making sure that their teams didn't fall into kind of a self-righteous, closed-minded groupthink syndrome, and that the teams actually turned out to be more rather than less than the sum of the parts.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's take a call. Mary is with us in Salt Lake City. Mary, welcome.
Thank you. This is a fascinating discussion. I'd like your guest to discuss an experience I've had through my life, and that is based on very little information. At times, I've been able to foresee how things were going. For instance, 2 or 3 years before the recession, I knew it was coming. And I've wondered about that through my lifetime. I majored in history. And I wonder if having to take exams like discuss the trends that led up to the Civil War, considering economic, social, political events, and I wonder if that could have been the mental training that has caused me to have this, I don't know if you'd call it a gift, but I certainly don't think of it as anything spiritual.
Okay. Well, okay, that's a good question. Could the humanities more broadly, or in particular history, could that in fact be good training for a super forecaster, I guess?
Well, I think historical knowledge is very important, and super forecasters often deploy historical analogies when informing their forecasts. I would suggest that the best way to discover whether one is a super forecaster, and Mary may indeed be a super forecaster for all I know, but the best way to do it is to keep systematic score. We're not very good at keeping score of ourselves. So there's a new forecasting tournament at gjopen.com, where thousands of forecasters are now making predictions on at least 100 or more questions that have been posed, and there'll be many more. So it's a good opportunity for assessing how skillful one is in attaching probability judgments to real-world events.
Are super forecasters more moderate in their ideology? It seems to be something that you hear a lot from pundits. They're very settled in a kind of ideology, and so their opinion is expressed based on this powerfully felt thing they have. Do super forecasters tend to be less inclined toward an ideology, less conservative or less liberal, for example?
If we're talking about statistical trends, I think there is some truth to what you're saying. I think they do tend to be more centrist. But it's also true, we're just talking about a statistical trend there. So there are plenty of super forecasters who are quite ideological, who do have quite strong ideological opinions. What they're able to do, though, is put those ideological opinions to the side when they go into the forecasting tournament. And I think that would be a very healthy thing for other people who have strong ideologies to do.
I wanted to ask you about some of the questions that came up. One of the things that I found interesting is that you kind of put Tom Friedman to the test to some degree, whether he was really good at forecasting or not. And that's questionable, whether he was better at forecasting than a super forecaster, certainly not. But you did say that he was certainly good at asking the right questions. And I wanted you to say something about that, because I think the questions are really important here, at least the way that we frame them, I suppose.
I think that's the agenda for future research. Yeah. It will be tournaments in which people compete not just to generate accurate forecasts, but to generate high-quality questions, questions that we really would like to have the answers to. And when we look back in history and we say, gee, I wish I had posed that question. A good example of that in the book is a column that Tom Friedman wrote just before the U.S. decision to invade Iraq in 2003, in which he posed, I think it was a quite brilliant question, very, very pithily. He said, is Iraq the way it is today because Saddam Hussein is the way he is? Or is Saddam Hussein the way he is because Iraq is the way it is?
Right.
That is a wonderful question. And I think if the U.S. intelligence community had grappled more explicitly with it, and if the administration had grappled more explicitly with it, they would have been warier of invading Iraq.
What does this tell us? What have you learned about leaders, political leaders? Is there a contradiction between the qualities of good leadership and the demands of good judgment, for example?
There can be.
Yeah.
If you're a hockey coach and your team is behind 3-1 in the Stanley Cup Finals, and some reporter sticks a microphone in your face and says, "Hey, coach, you think your team has a chance?" And you actually pause and think about the real probabilities of winning, and you say, probably not, you're not going to be regarded as a good coach.
Right.
You're going to be regarded as a loser. You're supposed to say, of course we're going to win, because your job is not to make accurate probability judgments in a forecasting tournament. Your job is to inspire the troops, mobilize them, charge them up with enthusiasm. And leaders often have these conflicting imperatives. Truth is often a very secondary thing for people in business and political leadership roles. We don't like to talk that much about it, but there is some truth to that.
Some areas, you point out, are always going to have some level of irreducible uncertainty. No matter how good you are, a super forecaster is not going to be able to settle on certain things. But you do say that there are some areas where super forecasters can make an impact. I wanted you to just mention some of these international conflicts, I think you pointed out. Maybe financial markets too?
I think that super forecasters can be very helpful in depolarizing unnecessarily polarized debates about either domestic or international issues. At the end of the book, we talk about the extraordinarily polemical debate between Paul Krugman, the New York Times economist, and Niall Ferguson, an economic historian. These are brilliant people, but the debate is not very illuminating. It generates far more heat than it does light. And the question is, how can we configure these debates so that they become more informative? And one way of doing that is by getting each side to be willing to state their expectations in a way that they can be falsified. So if you really think that there's going to be a global depression next year, you should assign a probability to the global economy contracting by, say, more than 4% in 2016. And so forth. I mean, you basically, I guess the proverbial expression would be you put your money where your mouth is, or you put your reputation where your mouth is.
This seemed compelling to me that you mentioned your conversation with Ferrucci, who was the one who engineered the machine, the computer that beat Ken Jennings and the other Jeopardy champions. He said that in the future, it seemed that listening to subjective opinions, like a Krugman, for example, or like a Ferguson, for example, that that's going to seem, he said, stranger and stranger to us. What does he mean? That we're going to be more, I don't know, are we going to be able to forego that part of our human nature that wants to hear someone who agrees with us and be more critical in the way we analyze these things?
I don't think we're ever going to be able to eliminate that part of human nature that likes to listen to people who flatter our preconceptions or our prejudices. I mean, we're wired up to like our preconceptions to be bolstered. But I think we can learn to be more skeptical of pundits. I think we can learn to be more skeptical of using substitution. We call them substitution heuristics. So if you asked a fan of Niall Ferguson or Paul Krugman, is this person a good forecaster? They would probably say yes. But you ask them, how do they know? They might be able to point to one or two forecasts that the person got right, but they don't have a track record. They're basing it essentially on this is a highly esteemed scholar who writes really well. They're using the status cues. They're using eloquence as substitutes for forecasting accuracy. Mm-hmm. Now, it may be the case that people who have high status and are eloquent are more likely to be super forecasters. I don't think that's true. I don't think it's very true. But there may be some trend in that direction, but it's probably not a very strong trend. And if you want to make rational decisions about how much credibility to infuse into a particular pundit, you really should want to know what the track record is and not simply go with proxies like, boy, that was a rip-roaring argument that made me feel good about my point of view. That was a really clever put down of that guy.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about the Ten Commandments for super forecasters, which I really liked this. It's essentially kind of like a training system where these different subjects, 10 of them here, of course, to help, you know, prospective, I guess, super forecasters work on their skills. And I wanted to go through a few of these. Let's start with triage. I guess that's as good as a place as any. Do you want to say something about this first point?
Sure. Triage is the art of picking problems that are solvable. You're not going to win a forecasting tournament if you only decide to answer really easy questions, because everyone else is going to get them right too, and you're not going to have a comparative advantage there. Nice. You're also not going to win a forecasting tournament by choosing questions that are intractably hard, that are hopelessly cloud-like, trying to predict roulette wheel outcomes or radically uncertain outcomes. Nobody's going to do better than dart-throwing chimpanzee there by definition.
Right.
The best forecasters gravitate toward problems in what we call the Goldilocks zone of difficulty. These are problems that matter and that are tractable to some degree. Now, they're not really easy, but they're not impossibly hard. Who's going to win the presidential election in 2028 is impossibly hard. Who's going to win the presidential election in 2016 if one candidate is ahead by 5% one day before the election is really too easy. But who's going to win the presidential election in November 2016? And when you're asking that question in November 2015, mm-hmm. that is getting into the Goldilocks zone of difficulty.
Strike the right balance between inside and outside views. What's that about?
That is something that just does not come naturally to us at all. Mm-hmm. And it would be a big benefit if it did come more naturally. I can give you many examples of this. If you're at a wedding and you see a happy couple, and it's virtually impossible to imagine that you think the couple's very compatible, and you're very hard to imagine they're getting divorced, and someone asks you, has the bad taste to ask you just after the wedding, how likely do you think it is that they're going to get divorced? You're going to attach an extremely low probability. Say, I can't imagine two people who love each other that much getting divorced. I think maybe 2%.
Right.
Now, when you look at the divorce statistics in the country, it depends on what kind of what your socioeconomic status and religion and region is. But let's say the national is something like between 30 and 40% divorce rate. I'm not sure what it is right now. But if the divorce rate is that high, you should certainly take that into account in making your prediction. In fact, what the super forecasters would do is they would start with an estimate like, say, let's say the divorce rate is – base rate is 40%. That's the outside view. Yeah. They would say, well, my initial hunch is 40% because that's this is a tip. I'm just going to work on the assumption this is a fairly typical marriage because almost everybody looks happy when they're getting married.
Right.
And then they would say, now, how should I adjust that based on the religiosity, the personalities, and so the the incomes, the job stability, and so forth of this couple. And they might get closer to 2% as a result of doing that. But they're going to start with 40, and then they're going to work down fairly slowly and appropriately as a function of the additional individuating information about the couple.
We don't have time to go through all of these. Strike the right balance between under and overreacting to evidence. Strike the right balance between under and overconfidence, between prudence and decisiveness. This is great, though, and this is sort of the 11th of the 10. Don't treat commandments as commandments. What's that about?
You should doubt us just as you doubt everything
right.
else. We're not perfect. We make lots of mistakes, and you shouldn't assume that super forecasters are always going to be right. I think if you're a betting person, you probably don't want to bet often against the super forecasters. But you know, you will sometimes be right when you bet against the super forecasters.
Yeah. And let me ask you this finally. We've less than a minute left, so maybe there's not enough time to really get at this. But it is interesting. I did wonder, how good is American intelligence forecasting? Because you say the intelligence community has never really wanted to figure that out. Are we getting to a conclusion there? Do we know?
I think they live in a blame game political culture in which they feel they will be punished severely if they make explicit judgments on the wrong side of maybe. So they don't want, I think, to use numerical probability judgments as long as they have to exist in that kind of a political culture, which is otherwise known as democracy. So they're naturally reluctant to do that. But I can imagine they're gradually moving toward numbers in private estimates, just as I can imagine, say, the Federal Reserve has.
Yeah. Philip Tetlock. His book is Super Forecasting, The Art and Science of Prediction, co-written with Dan Gardner. The professor joined us today from the campus of the Wharton Business School in Philadelphia. Professor, thanks for taking the time.
No, it's my pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.